This is Catherine Hastings, and you're listening to Word Temple on KRCB 91.1 FM. In just a little bit here, I'm going to be airing an interview and reading by Marin County poet Terry Lucas. He's the author of the book In This Room, published by CW Books, an imprint of WordTech Communications. But because it's December, we have a tradition going on here. No matter if you celebrate Christmas or not, we can always celebrate Dylan Thomas reading his wonderful short story, A Child's Christmas in Wales. So let's start out with that. Here's Dylan Thomas.
One Christmas was so much like the other in those years around the Seatown corner now, out of all sound except the distant speaking of the voices I sometimes hear a moment before sleep, that I can never remember whether it snowed for 6 days and 6 nights when I was 12, or whether it snowed for 12 days and 12 nights when I was 6. All the Christmases rolled down towards the two-tongued sea like a cold and headlong moon bundling down the sky that was our street. And they stop at the rim of the ice-edged, fish-freezing waves, and I plunge my hands in the snow and bring out whatever I can find. In goes my hand into that wool-white, bell-tongued ball of holidays resting at the rim of the carol-singing sea. And out come Mrs. Prothero and the firemen. It was on the afternoon of the day of Christmas Eve, and I was in Mrs. Prothero's garden, waiting for cats with her son Jim. It was snowing. It was always snowing at Christmas. December, in my memory, as white as Lapland, although there were no reindeers. But there were cats. Patient, cold, and callous, our hands wrapped in socks, we waited to snowball the cats. Sleek and long as jaguars and horrible whiskered, spitting and snarling, they would slide and sidle over the white back garden walls, and the lynx-eyed hunters, Jim and I, fur-capped and moccasined trappers from Hudson Bay off Mumbles Road, would hurl our deadly snowballs at the green of their eyes. The wise cats never appeared. We were so still, Eskimo-footed Arctic marksmen in the muffling silence of the eternal snows, eternal ever since Wednesday, that we never heard Mrs. Prothero's first cry from her igloo at the bottom of the garden. Or if we heard it at all, it was to us like the far-off challenge of our enemy and prey, the neighbor's polar cat. But soon the voice grew louder. Fire! Cried Mrs. Prothero, and she beat the dinner gong. And we ran down the garden with the snowballs in our arms towards the house, and smoke indeed was pouring out of the dining room, and the gong was bombolating, and Mrs. Prothero was announcing ruin like a town crier in Pompeii. This was better than all the cats in Wales standing on the wall in a row. We bounded into the house laden with snowballs and stopped at the open door of the smoke-filled room. Something was burning, all right. Perhaps it was Mr. Prothero, who always slept there after midday dinner with a newspaper over his face. But he was standing in the middle of the room saying, "A fine Christmas," and smacking at the smoke with a slipper. "Call the fire brigade," cried Mrs. Prothero as she beat the gong. "They won't be here," said Mr. Prothero. "It's Christmas." There was no fire to be seen, only clouds of smoke, and Mr. Prothero standing in the middle of them, waving his slipper as though he were conducting. "Do something," he said. And we threw all our snowballs into the smoke. I think we missed Mr. Prothero, and ran out of the house to the telephone box. "Let's call the police as well," Jim said, "and the ambulance. And Ernie Jenkins, he likes fires." But we only called the fire brigade. And soon the fire engine came, and three tall men in helmets brought a hose into the house, and Mr. Prothero got out just in time before they turned it on. Nobody could have had a noisier Christmas Eve. And when the firemen turned off the hose and were standing in the wet, smoky room, Jim's aunt, Miss Prothero, came downstairs and peered in at them. Jim and I waited very quietly to hear what she would say to them. She said the right thing, always. She looked at the three tall firemen in their shining helmets, standing among the smoke and cinders and dissolving snowballs, and she said, "Would you like anything to read?" Years and years ago, when I was a boy, when there were wolves in Wales, and birds the color of red flannel petticoats whisked past the harp-shaped hills, when we sang and wallowed all night and day in caves that smelt like Sunday afternoons in damp front farmhouse parlors, and we chased with the jawbones of deacons the English and the bears. Before the motor car, before the wheel, before the Duchess-faced horse, when we rode the daft and happy hills bareback, it snowed and it snowed. But here a small boy says, "It snowed last year, too. I made a snowman and my brother knocked it down, and I knocked my brother down, and then we had tea. But that was not the same snow, I say. Our snow was not only shaken from whitewashed buckets down the sky. It came shawling out of the ground and swam and drifted out of the arms and hands and bodies of the trees. Snow grew overnight on the roofs of the houses like a pure and grandfather moss, minutely ivied the walls and settled on the postman opening the gate like a dumb, numb thunderstorm of white, torn Christmas cards. Were there postmen then, too? With sprinkling eyes and wind-cherried noses on spread, frozen feet, they crunched up to the doors and mittened on them manfully. But all that the children could hear was a ringing of bells. You mean that the postman went rat-a-tat-tat and the doors rang? I mean that the bells that the children could hear were inside them. I only hear thunder sometimes, never bells. There were church bells, too. Inside them? No, in the bat-black, snow-white belfries tugged by bishops and storks. And they rang their tidings over the bandaged town, over the frozen foam of the powder and ice cream hills, over the crackling sea. It seemed that all the churches boomed for joy under my window, and the weathercocks crew for Christmas on our fence. Get back to the postman. They were just ordinary postmen, fond of walking and dogs and Christmas and the snow. They knocked on the doors with blue knuckles. Ours has got a black knocker. And then they stood on the white welcome mat in the little drifted porches and huffed and puffed, making ghosts with their breath, and jogged from foot to foot like small boys wanting to go out. And then the presents. And then the presents after the Christmas box. And the cold postman with a rose on his button nose tingled down the tea-tray slithered run of the chilly, glinting hill. He went in his ice-boned boots like a man on fishmonger's slabs. He wagged his bag like a frozen camel's hump, dizzily turned the corner on one foot, and by God, he was gone. Get back to the presents. There were the useful presents, engulfing mufflers of the old coach days and mittens made for giant sloths, zebra scarves of a substance like silky gum that could be tug-of-war down to the galoshes, blinding tam-o'-shanters like patchwork tea cozies and bunny-suited busbies and balaclavas for victims of head-shrinking tripes. From aunts who always wore wool next to the skin, there were moustached and rasping vests that made you wonder why the aunts had any skin left at all. And once I had a little crocheted nosebag from an aunt now, alas, no longer whinnying with us. And pictureless books in which small boys, though warned with quotations not to, would skate on Farmer Giles's pond and did and drowned. And books that told me everything about the wasp, except why. Go on to the useless presents. Bags of moist and many-colored jelly babies, and a folded flag and a false nose and a tram conductor's cap and a machine that punched tickets and rang a bell. Never a catapult. Once, by a mistake that no one could explain, a little hatchet. And a celluloid duck that made, when you pressed it, a most unduck-like sound, a mewing moo that an ambitious cat might make who wished to be a cow. and a painting book in which I could make the grass, the trees, the sea, and the animals any color I please. And still the dazzling sky-blue sheep are grazing in the red field under the rainbow-billed and pea-green birds. Hard-boiled, toffee, fudge, and all sorts, crunches, cracknel, humbugs, glaciers, marzipan, and butter Welsh for the Welsh. And troops of bright tin soldiers who, if they could not fight, could always run. And snakes and families and happy ladders and easy hobby games for little engineers, complete with instructions. Oh, easy for Leonardo. And a whistle to make the dogs bark, to wake up the old man next door, to make him beat on the wall with his stick, to shake our picture off the wall. And a packet of cigarettes. You put one in your mouth and you stood at the corner of the street and you waited for hours in vain for an old lady to scold you for smoking a cigarette, and then with a smirk you ate it. And then it was breakfast under the balloons. Were there uncles like in our house? There are always uncles at Christmas, the same uncles. And on Christmas mornings, with dog-disturbing whistle and sugar fags, I would scour the swathed town for the news of the little world and find always a dead bird by the post office or the white, deserted swings. Perhaps a robin, all but one of his fires out. Men and women wading, scooping back from chapel with taproom noses and wind-busked cheeks, all albinos, huddled their stiff black jarring feathers against the irreligious snow. Mistletoe hung from the gas brackets in all the front parlors. There was sherry and walnuts and bottled beer and crackers by the dessert spoons. And cats in their furabouts watched the fires. And the high-heaped fires spat, all ready for the chestnuts and the mulling pokers. Some few large men sat in the front parlors without their collars, uncles almost certainly, trying their new cigars, holding them out judiciously at arm's length, returning them to their mouths, coughing, then holding them out again as though waiting for the explosion. And some few small aunts, not wanted in the kitchen, nor anywhere else for that matter, sat on the very edges of their chairs, poised and brittle, afraid to break like faded cups and saucers. Not many those mornings trod the piling streets. An old man, always fawn-bowlered, yellow-gloved, and at this time of year with spats of snow, would take his constitutional to the white bowling green and back as he would take it wet or fire or on Christmas Day or Doomsday. Sometimes two hale young men with big pipes blazing, no overcoats and wind-blown scarves, would trudge unspeaking down to the forlorn sea to work up an appetite to blow away the fumes, who knows, to walk into the waves until nothing of them was left but the two curling smoke clouds of their inextinguishable briars. Then I would be slap-dashing home, the gravy smell of the dinners of others, the bird smell, the brandy, the pudding and mince coiling up to my nostrils, when out of a snow-clogged side lane would come a boy, the spit of myself, with a pink-tipped cigarette and the violet past of a black eye, cocky as a bullfinch, leering all to himself. I hated him on sight and sound, and would be about to put my dog whistle to my lips and blow him off the face of Christmas, when suddenly he, with a violet wink, put his whistle to his lips and blew so stridently, so high, so exquisitely loud, that gobbling faces, their cheek bulged with goose, would press against their tinseled windows the whole length of the white echoing street. For dinner we had turkey and blazing pudding, and after dinner the uncles sat in front of the fire, loosened all buttons, put their large, moist hands over their watch chains, groaned a little, and slept. Mothers, aunts, and sisters scuttled to and fro bearing tureens. Aunt Bessie, who had already been frightened twice by a clockwork mouse, whimpered at the sideboard and had some elderberry wine. The dog was sick. Auntie Dursey had to have three aspirins, but Auntie Hannah, who liked port, stood in the middle of the snowbound backyard, singing like a big bosomed thrush. I would blow up balloons to see how big they would blow up to, and then when they burst, which they all did, the uncles jumped and rumbled. In the rich and heavy afternoon, the uncles breathing like dolphins and the snow descending, I would sit among festoons and Chinese lanterns and nibble dates and try to make a model man-o-war, following the instructions for little engineers, and produce what might be mistaken for a sea-going tram car. Or I would go out, my bright new boots squeaking into the white world onto the seaward hill, to call on Jim and Dan and Jack, and to pad through the still streets, leaving huge, deep footprints on the hidden pavements. I bet people will think they've been hippos. What did you do if you saw a hippo coming down our street? I'd go like this, bang! I'd throw him over the railings and roll him down the hill, and then I'd tickle him under the ear and he'd wag his tail. What would you do if you saw two hippos? Iron-flanked and bellowing he-hippos clanked and battered through the scudding snow towards us as we passed Mr. Daniel's house. Let's post Mr. Daniel a snowball through his letterbox. Let's write things in the snow. Let's write, Mr. Daniel looks like a spaniel all over his lawn. Or we walked on the white shore. Can the fishes see it snowing? The silent, one-clouded heavens drifted onto the sea. Now we were snow-blind travelers lost on the North Hills, and vast, dew-lapped dogs with flasks around their necks ambled and shambled up to us, baying Excelsior. We returned home through the poor streets, where only a few children fumbled with bare red fingers in the wheel-rutted snow and cat-called after us, their voices fading away as we trudged uphill into the cries of the dock birds and the hooting of ships out in the whirling bay. And then at tea, the recovered uncles would be jolly, and the ice cake loomed in the center of the table like a marble grave. Auntie Hannah laced her tea with rum because it was only once a year. Bring out the tall tales now that we told by the fire as the gaslight bubbled like a diver. Ghosts wooed like owls in the long nights when I dared not look over my shoulder. Animals lurked in the cubbyhole under the stairs where the gas meter ticked. And I remember that we went singing carols once when there wasn't the shaving of a moon to light the flying street. At the end of a long road was a drive that led to a large house, and we stumbled up the darkness of the drive that night, each one of us afraid, each one holding a stone in his hand, in case, and all of us too brave to say a word. The wind through the trees made noises as of old and unpleasant and maybe web-footed men wheezing in caves. We reached the black bulk of the house. What shall we give them? Hark the herald? No, Jack said. Good King Wenceslas. I'll count three. One, two, three. And we began to sing, our voices high and seemingly distant in the snow-felted darkness round the house that was occupied by nobody we knew. We stood close together near the dark door. Good King Wenceslas last looked out on the feast of Stephen. And then a small, dry voice, like the voice of someone who has not spoken for a long time, joined our singing. A small, dry eggshell voice from the other side of the door. A small, dry voice through the keyhole. And when we stopped running, we were outside our house. The front room was lovely. Balloons floated under the hot water bottle, gulping gas. Everything was good again and shone over the town. Perhaps it was a ghost, Jim said. Perhaps it was trolls, Dan said, who was always reading. Let's go in and see if there's any jelly left, Jack said. And we did that. Always on Christmas night there was music. An uncle played the fiddle, a cousin sang Cherry Ripe, and another uncle sang Drake's Drum. It was very warm in the little house. Auntie Hannah, who had got onto the parsnip wine, sang a song about bleeding hearts and death, and then another in which she said her heart was like a bird's nest. And then everybody laughed again, and then I went to bed. looking through my bedroom window out into the moonlight and the unending smoke-colored snow. I could see the lights in the windows of all the other houses on our hill and hear the music rising from them up the long, steadily falling night. I turned the gas down. I got into bed. I said some words to the close and holy darkness, and then I slept.
That was Dylan Thomas reading his own work, A Child's Christmas in Wales. It's something I just love hearing every December. Okay, we're going to move on now to an interview with Marin County poet Terry Lucas. Here we go. This is Catherine Hastings, and you are listening to Word Temple on KRCB 91.1 FM. My next guest is Marin County poet Terry Lucas. He is not only a poet, he is an essayist, a reviewer, an editor, and freelance poetry coach. He's the author of two poetry chapbooks, Altar Call, published in Diesel, the anthology of the San Gabriel Valley Literary Festival, and If They Have Ears to Hear, which won the 2012 Copper Dome Award from Southeast Missouri State University Press. He's here today to read from his first full-length poetry collection, In This Room, which was published by CW Books. And I'm also going to be asking him about his second book coming out, Dharma Rain, but we'll get to that later. His poems have appeared widely in journals, including Best New Poets of 2012, Crab Orchard Review, Fifth Wednesday Journal, and others. He is the co-executive editor of Trio House Press, something else I'll be asking him about during this interview. Welcome, Terry. It's
Thank
good
you.
To see you. So where in Marin County do you live?
Where Mill Valley.
Mill Valley.
Right.
Well, I mentioned Trio House Press
Yes.
in this introduction. So before we get to your poetry, why don't you tell me just a little bit about that. I know you published our Sonoma County Poet Laureate, Iris Jamal Dunkel.
Yes.
Her book was called Gold Passage.
Yes.
So tell me about your press.
Well, I started writing late in life. I didn't start writing seriously until I was about 50. And in 2006, I went back and got my poetry MFA from a low residency program at New England College.
Uh-huh.
And the class of eight that graduated together pretty much stuck together after our graduation, even though we were, you know, at all points on the map. We
Right.
exchanged poems monthly and wrote each other essays about the work we were reading. And after doing that for a couple of years, we wanted to do something more. And three of us, actually, it was not my decision to start a press. It's not something I would have done by myself. But
uh-huh.
Tave Neese, who mm-hmm. is my co-executive editor, wanted to start a small independent press. And she tapped Dorinda Wegener and me to assist her, along with Sarah Lefsick, who was also a graduate of NEC. So that's how the press got started. We had not yet published any of our own manuscripts, and we were realizing how difficult it is to get published as a poet. We didn't know then what we know now. There's about 6,000 poetry books published a year. There are probably 600,000 poets looking to get published every
right.
year.
Right.
And but we felt like we wanted to make a contribution to poetry, be a good poetry citizen before we had our own books published, and just mm-hmm. see how that worked out. So that's how we decided to start the press. We're not a vanity press. We've not published our own work, of course.
Right.
But
right.
interestingly enough, since we have started the press, each one of us have had our own books published.
Oh, that's great. Congratulations
Thank
to
you.
All of you.
Thank you.
So we're here to kind of celebrate your first full-length collection
Thank you.
Of poems, In This Room. It was published by CW Books of Word Tech Communications.
Yes.
And I know that Word Tech has maybe six different imprints, depending on what kind of poetry is
they
submitted.
Do.
So
yes.
yours was published under CW Books, which I think lends more in their minds to more experimental poetry rather than, you know, narrative verse or
right.
something else.
So right.
Did you submit your work as an experimental?
I did not.
Or was it a surprise?
It was a surprise,
yeah.
as a matter of fact. Whenever WordTech asks for submissions, they ask for two or three presses that you feel like that it should fall under. And so I selected Lyrical Narrative, which I'm not sure, I think it's Cherry Grove, and Narrative. And I did not even think that it would be, you know, diverse poetry. But I think because of the middle section about the, that surrounds the Golden Gate Bridge, there are some nonce forms there that are a little unusual. And so I think that's probably why Kevin Walzer placed it in that category.
Yeah, you know, that was my own thought. After I read the book, I was like, well, why experimental? And the only thing I could lean to was the long poem on the Golden Gate Bridge. So, okay, well, that makes some sense. You know, who knows the thinking of editors and publishers? I'm just glad that the book is out there.
Thank you.
So, let's start right off with the title poem of this book.
Okay.
Would you read In This Room? There's some really nice deep imagery in it, along with a mention of a few jazz greats. I think you're a jazz aficionado.
Thank you. I will. In this room, a long playing record is turning on the turntable. For some time, speakers have been faithfully amplifying the scratches residing behind Art or Miles or Freddie. With a metronomic ticking, the needle bumping up against the label, sending the tone arm veering back across the smooth gap like a saxophonist swaying on stage, or a drunk driving a black-iced road on a new moon night, searching for the center line. But these are mere musings. From another room, there might be the moaning of lovers over the hiss of knees caressing satin sheets. And who is to say which is more holy? Heaven's music or hell's static electricity. The arm holding the needle in the groove, legs rising and falling out of time, moonlight flushing the dry flesh of curled leaves blowing across the road that has tangled itself in the hills like a necklace in my mother's long hair fanned out on my father's pillow. And what am I but the valley between them, a watershed of snowmelt and shade? A cry from one far peak to another, an avalanche of sound echoing between the walls of yet another room, where a trembling index finger is lowering the stylus, aiming the needle for the edge of a black vinyl record.
Very nice.
Thank
you. Very nice. When I first read this poem, the second line ends with that phrase, faithfully amplifying the scratches, residing behind art. Uppercase art, and you think for a split second it's art, and then you move to the next line, or Miles or Freddie, and you're in the land of jazz all of a sudden.
Yes,
very, very nice line break there.
Thank you very much.
I noticed that there's no bio for you in the book, but the collection tells us a bit about you and about your childhood, your past. So where did you grow up?
And I grew up in New Mexico. I'm actually a Midwestern boy. I was born in Cleveland, Ohio. My parents are from Southern Illinois. And we lived in Ohio and Southern Illinois until I was nine. My father came to work in the oil fields in New Mexico when I was nine. In fact, he walked out in the front yard while I was playing and said, Daddy's got to go find work. And he hitchhiked west, not knowing where he would end up. And he found work in Farmington, New Mexico, in the oil fields. Worked there for a year and a half. Then he came back, used his GI Bill, got us, moved us to New Mexico, and bought a house with the GI Bill. And so from the time I was nine until the time I graduated from high school, we lived in Farmington. Then I graduated from New Mexico State in Las Cruces.
Las Cruces is beautiful.
Las Cruces is beautiful. Yeah. Yes, it is. When I first met my partner, Janet Goodman, who I lived with in Mill Valley, we were talking about how many places we'd lived, and I had added up that I have had 43 mailing addresses in my adult life.
Wow.
And that was in 2006. That was 10 years ago. We've been together 10 years now. So I've lived lots of different places, including Texas, including Chicago, including Canada for 1 year.
How did you get to California?
I came to California because of work. I was transferred here. The company I was working for made me the regional manager of the West Coast, and that's how I got here. So,
you're listening to Word Temple on KRCB 91.1 FM. Let's return now to Terry Lucas. some of the childhood experiences that I pick up in your have to do with church and religion. So I was going to ask you to read The Spell.
Okay.
Next, if that's all right.
Yes, I would be more than happy to. The Spell. And it does have an epigraph. And he shall separate them one from another, as a shepherd divideth his sheep from the goats. Matthew 25:32b. By age 7, I was smitten with God, seduced, and turned into one of his sheep. At prayer meetings, I made special requests for Brother Valley West's phantom arm to stop aching, for the doctors giving Sister Catherine shock treatments in the asylum to be filled with Holy Ghost healing power. And the entire congregation would come round after the benediction, hugging and kissing me on the mouth, wanting a taste of the red coal Brother Swinford said God had touched to my lips as he had to Isaiah's. It was true. The spell was good enough for me to preach my first sermon at 11, earn an advanced degree in religion, spend half a lifetime in fumbling foreplay with God, trying so hard in the dark to feel some bulge under all those layers, straining for release from bituminous desire, tongue glowing just below the flashpoint of faith's flame. And later I understood the white ash in the corners of my mouth, the cooling, the slake of thirst. But now I really don't know what to make of that spell, how it entered me like an abusive shepherd who all along must have known that there would come a day of judgment and a night before when the first tufts of wolf fur showed through the wool.
You know, this is one example of many in here where the ultimate line of your poem just kind of blows you away. So let's talk just for a minute about this. You know,
yes.
You were a religious person
yes.
as a young person.
Yes. Actually, probably 80% of this poem is actual history. I was a childhood preacher. I was tapped. I grew up in a very fundamental Southern Baptist church that started in Southern Illinois that carried over into New Mexico. And I always was tapped by the adults as someone who had the gift of preaching from God. So I started at a very early age, standing on a little orange crate behind the pulpit, you know, delivering sermons and calling for people to come down to accept Jesus and
be saved.
That's right.
Yeah.
The fundamental religion that I grew up with had its good roots and it also had its bad roots. And for years, I actually went then to seminary, graduated from seminary, and was on mm-hmm. was a minister on church staff for about 3 years.
Wow!
And when I was 29 or 30, I basically left my then wife, the ministry, and God all at one time. But in my later years, I have returned and reexamined the good roots mm-hmm. To that religion, and am now a person of faith and have a spiritual life.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a traditional religious life in the sense that that it was whenever I was a child, and I don't preach anymore. But but poetry has been my spiritual spiritual pilgrimage for many years.
What a time of your life to sever so much of your life and just start anew. It
yeah.
must have been so freeing at that time.
It was.
Terrifying and freeing.
It was
right?
terrifying and freeing, yes.
Wow. Well, thank you for that.
Yeah.
So I also noticed that a number of your poems were written after other poets, like the
yes.
late wonderful Larry Levis,
yes.
Contemporary poets like Ilya Kaminsky, who
yes.
read for Word Temple years ago,
yes.
Yusuf Kumanyaka, etc. So were these poems the result of exercises for you or... just admiration for these poets? Where did they come from?
Mainly, I would get the idea for a poem by reading their work. In some instances, it would be a particular poem, which is, in the instance of Ilya Kaminsky, that poem actually rearranged one line from one of his poems. You know, his book, Dancing in Odessa.
Yes, his first book from
yes.
Tupelo Press.
Yes,
yeah.
yes. He has a poem in there that actually has a line that I basically rearranged. Let's see if I can t- tell you which one it is.
Good, yeah. Why don't you go ahead and read that poem?
Okay,
for us.
Certainly. I believe the first line, he says, if I speak for, and it's he's for something else, I must mm-hmm. dance. And I like the idea, if I speak for something, then I must dance. And so mm-hmm. I just substituted for God for that line. The Augur's Prayer after Ilya Kaminsky. If I speak for God's silence, I must dance inside the womb of my mother, my tongue growing inside her, a flaming root pushing through humus. I must fill my cheeks with the arid breath of my father, nursed from his dry breasts. If I speak for God's silence, I must rest inside stones that line the path of his son's triumphal entrance. I must scatter myself like seed carried away by wrens, or feed like hawks on the flesh of thieves hanging on Golgotha, stripped carcasses of men with wings for faces.
Nice. Very nice. I think it's good to steal some things now and then to, right. you know, get us moving with our own
exactly.
with our own work. Well, you seemed you mentioned your father, and he was an interesting person to show up in these poems, and I'll get there in a second. But you also seem to have an interesting relationship with your mother, mm-hmm. especially when it comes to writing, and she wasn't exactly encouraging.
I
get that hint. And you have a poem called The Reading.
Yes.
And I'd love to hear that one and share that with our audience.
Yes. The Reading. Las Cruces, 1970. The sun is playing the brilliant pipes of the Organ Mountains for the full moon. I am returning to my dormitory room from a poetry reading, my first time to hear William Stafford or any other world-class poet. I listened between each poem to the lecture my mother gave me when I was 9, the night she discovered my spiral pocket notebook, sat me down at the kitchen table, read each faded page aloud, asked me how hard I imagined my father had to work to buy the paper I had wasted. What might possess a good boy like me to do such a thing? Afterwards, she ripped out the poems, smearing the blue lines with her dirty dishwater hands, led me to the bathroom, threw it all into the toilet, made me flush. I take the long path back home through sagebrush, salt cedar, seared sand. The sun has disappeared. The mountains are beached whales having sung their last song. The moon, a cracked white plate on an inky table of sky. I reach inside my jacket pocket, feel the cool dust cover of traveling through the dark, run a thumb down the spine of my new spiral notebook, whisper, "It's going to be a long night, Mother." I'm actually right now writing memoir, and in the past 3 months I have almost 300 pages down, and so I'm going back and examining, you know, some of the stories that mm-hmm. That fill my childhood and fill my life up until the time I was 30. And one of the things that I recalled recently was a conversation that she had with me in my junior year at New Mexico State, when I met Keith Wilson, the New Mexican mm-hmm. poet, who really turned me on to poetry. And he actually did introduce me to William Stafford, and I did really attend that reading in mm-hmm. sometime 1970, 71. I don't really remember exactly when. But I'll never forget telling her that, you know, I'd met a professor who had introduced me to poetry and had really turned my life around. And she asked me one question. She said, "Is he a Christian?" And I said, "You know, Mom, I really don't know." And she said, "You have to be very careful listening to any teachings from anyone if you don't know whether they're a Christian or not." And that's all she ever said. And wow. She basically just dismissed, you know, my interest in poetry. My mother was anxiety ridden, and she was not a bad person or an evil person. I tell people that whenever I was a child, my mother treated me like a child. When I became an adult, she still treated me like a child.
Yeah, and I think it's kind of common.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah. And she was depressed. She was clinically depressed probably all of her life. But she did have some obsessions, and one of them was about eating food that might be tainted in some way. So mm-hmm. that's about this. Phaseolus lunatus. My mother's ER bag was always packed, and sitting at the front door when I cooked butter beans, which she swore were poisonous undercooked. Every emergency room doctor in San Juan County Hospital knew her burgeoning phobia. Every nurse the name Phaseolus lunatus. Written on the white label stuck to a Ziploc plastic bagged sample of my beans. Snap, green, wax, kidney. It made no difference what species. They had to be boiled to mush in a lidded pot, drained and reheated in fresh water. If not, the cramps began. The accusations that I was trying to kill her again. The get a sample of the poison beans, I'm getting my bag and heading to the car conversation. In the waiting room for an hour or more, mother lying behind closed curtains, we would get the same report back from the lab. Negative. When we told her she'd get out of bed, dress, go home, later open up that bag, take out house coat, gown, bottles, vials, repack it all, freight it to the front closet, then ask for something to eat. May I please have a plate of some nice mushy beans?
There's such a sadness to that poem, such a deep sadness. You know, I have to assume she was a very religious person. You know, she had a lot of faith in things that were not worldly, but things that were worldly presented a real problem. Yeah,
that's really the meaning behind the poem. And, you know, someone asked me, you know, one time, you know, how much of these poems really happened, you know? Mm-hmm. And I just picked a number. I said 71%. I mean, you know, I have no idea at this point how memory and reality blend. But every poem is emotionally true.
Absolutely.
And much of the historical statements have a basis, you know, in reality that I experienced, if not every detail. Mm-hmm. And I think that's I think that's what poetry is about. Mm-hmm. You know, it's taking truth and making art from it. I know you probably know the poet Dorian Lotz.
Oh yeah.
I love what she says in workshops whenever someone is given a critique of a line or a word in a poem, and their response is, "Oh." But that's the way it really happened. You know, I can't take that out.
Right.
That's the way it really happened.
I have to be exact.
Yes. And Dorian's response, which I love, is, "We love you, but we really don't care."
Yeah.
You know, and she she goes on to add, it's not about you. It's not about the history and what actually happened. It's about the poem.
Yeah,
so, you know, you say that there's a cow coming over the hill. If it's better for the poem that a swarm of bees is coming over the hill, then that's what it needs to be.
Good. Yeah, I like that too. I like that too. Well, let's go to your father for a minute.
Right.
I had the impression that he was a truck driver.
He was.
And so there's a poem called Lesson that kind of gives us the idea that he was a very strict person and had his unique ways of showing it. If you would read Lesson, that would
I
be
will.
Great.
You're going to remember. Oh, I see now. It's in 27. Lesson. My father once broke a man's tailbone with the toe of his roach killer boot for having an American flag sewn on the seat of his jeans. Doctors dug denim from his rectum, stars from his colon, kept him in the hospital. My father paid him a visit, gave him a Bible and a history lesson, North Africa, Sicily, Anzio, Salerno, told him why he didn't like the places some people put the flag his buddies died for. Then my father left a blank check at the front desk, pointed his white Freightliner west, depressed the accelerator with his freshly spit-shined boot, spider-veined with scars that would never buff out.
Was this kind of anger something that you saw a lot, or was it very...
I did. My father was a larger-than-life person. He actually... His story is remarkable. He hitchhiked. He hopped a freight train when he was 9 years old in the Great Depression. Ran away from home because his father was abusing him, and didn't go back until he was 14. Lived the life with hobos. Was basically adopted by some prostitutes in New Orleans and stayed with them for a while. Went back when he was 14. He told me that his father came at him again one time. And you know, he basically beat his father up and left and never went back. And his entire life was a life of being on the road. Okay. He was a World War II veteran. I call him a hero. He went through a lot in World War II. And then when he came home, he basically drove an 18-wheeler for 40 years, basically, because he couldn't live with my mother.
Wow, that's a long time.
They'd gotten married. They only had 3 dates before Pearl Harbor. And they got married like so many people did right after Pearl Harbor. Both of them were, you know, raised as fundamental Southern Baptists, and sex before marriage was just not something was acceptable. So, you know, my father told me that he basically married my mother so they could have sex before he went to the war.
There's a good reason to marry.
Yeah, my mother told me that the reason that she married him was she figured he'd never come back from the war. So he had PTSD before that word was even used.
Sure.
He was very angry, and you know, that anger came out in violence toward other people. I'm grateful that he never killed anyone, because he could have easily killed someone. With all of the fights that he got into and the situations he got into, you know, in those 40 years.
You know, to know about post-traumatic stress syndrome now and to have the hindsight of knowing that, you know, he had PTSD coming home from the war with no recognition of what that problem was, what could be done for him.
Exactly.
He just gets in a truck and spends 40 years in it, right?
Yeah. Exactly.
To be away from his family.
Right.
And his family was probably relieved to some extent because of the anger, right?
Yeah. Absolutely. I know I was. I mean, because every time he came home, it was basically warfare between him and my mother, you know.
Well, you have a long sequence in the book, which we mentioned earlier. It starts out as a kind of an ode to the Golden Gate Bridge. It's called The Gate.
Yes.
And I won't ask you to read the whole poem here, but I want to give our listeners enough of an idea so they're going to go out and get this book.
Okay, that'd be nice.
So I'd love it if you'd read the opening segment, which is one of my favorite parts of the whole book, I have to say.
Okay, which is the gate to the Golden Gate Bridge?
Yes, the gate.
Yeah, okay, certainly. The gate to the Golden Gate Bridge. By the way, you know, I'll say the obvious here. Much inspiration from Hart Crane's book, our long poem, The Bridge. And this first section actually has the same number of stanzas. It's in quatrains like his proem to The Bridge is. And I tried to do, again, emotionally, the same kind of thing he did for the Brooklyn Bridge, I tried to do for the Golden Gate Bridge.
And you even have a phrase from The Bridge in there, don't you? I do.
Okay. A sigh of stars
is
in italics in the fourth line, correct. To the Golden Gate Bridge. How many sunsets have white hairs of fog fallen from the headlands, collected in the gate's throat like fleece beneath a sigh of stars? How many torn moonairs up all night, listening for the feverish cries of gulls sweeping vermilion waves through restless shadows? I think of the sepia harvested for ink from octopus, cuttlefish, and squid, how they glow with phosphorescence that reaches its greatest intensity a few days after they are dead. And you, golden blade, surrogate stitch in the continent's deep wound, superating your stories out to sea, stories of limestone, ash, and lava. How many times have your waters parted, dissolving into nothing, then starting up again in the life of this shorn planet? How many worlds collided to flood this valley, slice its hills into islands? How many words strung together into sonnets beneath your harp strings, rising like incense, like a web of vines stretching to the mountains to which we look for help, shrouded in burning clouds, smoking by day, glowing by night? How many foghorns pressed into the dark wall of sleep, like swollen seeds thumbed into humus, sprouting to the surface, waiting for the sun, that one faithful fire eye blinking through the mist, searching for its twin, the earth, and all its fullness, which turns art to life, life to art, the truest of all lovers. How many nights has your watery bed swayed beneath your broad back? How many days has the bay rolled open its scroll of ciphers, the moon squinting to read the pages of the surf all in one glance, before they fade on a loom of soggy loam, weaving a landscape that is more like itself than itself, at each power of magnification, each level of imagination, twisting like snowflakes in an earthquake, ragged white corpuscles swimming up the bloodstream to the headwaters of the brain, where fractals mediate between the amygdala and the Dalai Lama, the pain of wisdom and the ecstasy of speech, the last cigarette and the iron sea.
Oh, thank you. That's really lovely.
Thank you. I must honor also a poet, Srikanth Reddy. I did not italicize pretty much the entire third stanza, I think, of the sepia harvested for ink from octopus, cuttlefish, and squid. Mm-hmm. I reworked a stanza of his in one of his books that he did a cross out poems from Kurt Waldheim's memoirs.
Oh, interesting.
He's a Chicago poet, and I have to give him his just due because I stole a lot of that language in the third stanza, and I just want to acknowledge that.
Well, it's beautiful. I'm sure it was beautiful in its origin and what you've done with it here as well. So I'm gonna change my mind because I'm gonna ask you to read one more section of this poem.
Certainly.
I wasn't planning on doing
that.
Okay. But if you would read number 4.
Yes. Yes.
That would be great. And that'll give the listeners a further idea of where this poem goes.
Yes, yes. Yeah, part of this poem, you know, is the history going back a million years, as you know, to the section that we call the gate, you know, the over which the Golden Gate Bridge was built, that used to be an inland sea, the river going out to the shore. Actually, that was about 24 miles west of where the ocean is now in San Francisco. And it honors that geological history, but it also honors, the approximately 1,500 or 1,600 people who have jumped to their death from the Golden Gate Bridge since it was built in 1937. So that stretch of land has such a history that it's amazing. I just felt the richness of it and felt like it deserved to be honored. So thank you. 4. One harness boot is propped on the bottom rail of the 4-foot fence under light pole 97, the first beyond the South Tower on the city side. He points toward Angel Island, Alcatraz, the piers. But all that is visible is bare arm blurring into fog, appearing as one of the muscular cables holding up the roadbed, fading into lead sky on either side, reminding him of photographs of the half-constructed bridge, towers standing in water, ripped arms reaching out to each other, to each shore, two crosses fleshed out daily by accretion of steel and the street lamps glow above him. A color midway between moon and setting sun, giving the comfort of one naked light bulb hanging from a frozen barn rafter, the smell of hay mingled with horses in the gelid breeze blowing in from the Pacific, long black hair lifting off his shoulders, whipping around his face, cheeks warming momentarily before he plants palms on the top rail, braces, then lifts damp eyes, turns, and retraces his steps. In the same way that my father was on the road for 40 years, I worked in retail almost 40 years. And of course, everyone knows that Black Friday is the Friday.
Following Thanksgiving.
Following
right?
Thanksgiving, that's right.
Like, stop eating and go spend your money.
That's right. Because that was the day that many small businesses went from being in the red to being in the black because of all of the business that they had that day. Black Friday. At 6 a.m., I turn into the mall parking lot, steer around speed bumps, nose the Accord into its reserved spot. Already, sticks of manicured coppice are blushing muted rose and sage. Already, light is pooling on car hoods, graying the roof over the Gap, Victoria's Secret, Starbucks, opening up to cathedral space where the closer I get to you, the more you make me see, is looping endlessly between food courts and anchor stores. Outside, customers press against smudged glass doors, pale envelopes of coupons and double bonus dollars in their fists. I crack the car door and twist both feet to work my Allen Edmund wingtips from floorboard to pavement without scuffing mirrored toes. See my body follow with measured obedience, slip through hordes, lift the grated metal gate to my tailored clothing store, enter code to deactivate the alarm, then disappear behind a wall of worsted wool, a flicker of the artificial lights before they catch. See me emerge, translucent plastic tubes of coins and rubber-banded bills in hand, count the drawers, reach inside my triple-pleated trouser pocket, pull out keys, walk to the door, extend my arm, welcome you into the maw of America.
Well, I have been asking you to read the poems I wanted to hear, and I feel a little selfish, but I get to do that.
That's fine.
So why don't you choose just maybe two more poems of your own choice that you would like to have on this program.
Okay, I will. I'm going to read a poem entitled 1967, and I'm dedicating it to all of my classmates from my high school, Farmington High School, in the year 1967. I have recently become reconnected with some of them through Facebook.
Of course.
Because our 50th anniversary is coming up of our graduation, and we're going to have a high school reunion back in Farmington. Wow. And I think one of the people who's in charge of the program is actually kind of asked ahead to see if I would read some poems there. So I know many of my high school graduates have purchased this book, and this is one of the poems that they spoke most about because it talks a little bit about the hometown where I grew up. 1967. It is after Larry Levis, because I love the way Larry Levis speaks about his youth and driving the cars that he drove and dating the girls that he dated. So that's why I put after Larry Levis.
Okay.
1967. I hear it mostly in the deep guttural tailpipes of Fords and Chevys revving out of a Friday afternoon high school parking lot in a small New Mexican desert town. Sunset Avenue pulsing like a neck vein that leads to the heart of downtown, where Main Street pumps cars all night, stoplight to stoplight, between the A&W drive-in and the Tasty Freeze. Engines overheating, then finally boiling over in ice-patched 2 a.m. driveways, cooling down with those ticking sounds of shrinking metal, rebuckling of belts, rehooking of bras. I'd like to talk to those boys behind the wheels, the girls curled up on humps between bucket seats. I'd like to tell them there is nothing out here in 2016 except what they bring with them, how they should climb out now and start packing, the juniper's needle leaves never pressed between pages of a Bible, the scorpion's breath exhaled through abdominal stigmata, sand swept from sagebrush roots lifted by the twisting fist of a dust devil, all collecting in luggaged silence. I'd like to tell them how there will always be enough falling brimstone, lakes of fire, flaming bushes, wilted flowers. How there will always be enough gods to punish them for putting their tongues to the warm clay, to turn them to salt for glancing back while walking away. How, when asked, where are you? What have you done? Who told you that you were naked? What they will need most will be to learn to love the questions.
You're listening to Word Temple. This is Catherine Hastings. You just heard Marin County poet Terry Lucas reading from his first full-length collection of poems, In This Room. I was hoping we'd have time to air a few of his poems from his upcoming book, Dharma Rain, but we just simply ran out of time. Before Terry, you heard Dylan Thomas reading his classic short story, A Child's Christmas in Wales. I hope you enjoyed tonight's program. If you have any questions or comments, do get in touch with me at khastings@wordtemple.com. Thanks for listening.